I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night, Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane was found guilty of 9 criminal charges, including perjury and conspiracy. She was accused of leaking grand jury information and lying about it to get revenge on a lawyer she believed was trying to undermine and discredit her. The unanimous verdict caps off a precipitous fall for the first woman to be the Commonwealth's top law enforcement officer. WHYY's Katie Culinary covered the trial and this case for Newsworks, and she joins us here in the studio. And Katie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks, Marty.
You were in the court last night. What was the response, especially from Kathleen King?
Yeah, you know, she sat there. She took it as the jury said that she was guilty on all 9 of the charges that she faced. And she really was rather stoic. She sat there and she watched, just as she did throughout the trial. She was very attentive, took notes. And the one striking thing that I did notice was, because the jury deliberations didn't start until about 4 o'clock and they stretched late into the evening, a lot of her family had gone home. Her parents had been there with her throughout the week, and other family members and even a police chief from up near Scranton, where she's from originally, had come to show his support for her. But during the verdict, the only person who was sitting in the front row supporting her was her twin sister, Ellen Granahan.
Interesting. And I know that they look very much alike.
They do indeed.
What was the most damning evidence, do you think, against Kathleen Kane?
Really, for me, as somebody sitting there in the courtroom, it was twofold. It was, one, the testimony of Josh Morrow. He's the political consultant who helped Kane with the leak. He's the one who actually delivered the confidential documents to the Philadelphia Daily News reporter, Chris Brennan, that got this story put out there. And he testified that he conspired with Kane to come up with a cover story, that they were going to blame this leak on Adrienne King, her first deputy attorney general at the time. And the other thing that kind of corroborated that was a phone call that had been recorded by the FBI, where he was talking to a friend of his, John Lisko, who used to work for the state treasurer, Rob McCord, who, of course, was
caught up in his own problems.
It got caught up in his own problems. And as part of that FBI investigation, his phone call with Josh Morrow was recorded. And it occurred a mere few hours after Kane had asked him to deliver these documents. And he kind of lays out the whole thing very candidly and really, puts the blame on her for saying, these are the documents we're going to leak and this is what we're going to do.
And Adrienne King, his testimony seemed to, underscore some of this?
He did. His testimony corroborated that. It corroborated the story that that Kane and Morrow had been telling, that they, that they were trying to frame him. And King got up on the stand and said, indeed, he felt like he was being framed by Morrow and Kane.
Well, I do want to play a clip, and this is something you got last night, Katie. This is Prosecutor Michelle Henry, and she is reacting to the verdict last night. Let's give it a listen.
What she did while she was the attorney general, the fact that she would commit criminal acts while she's the top prosecutor, is a disgrace.
And there are a number of people in this Commonwealth, including the governor, calling for her to resign.
Right.
There's been pressure for months now.
Oh, yeah. The pressure from both parties. But Governor Wolf has been calling on her to resign since she was arrested last year. And last night he put out a statement saying, she should resign immediately. Of course, she actually doesn't have to do that yet. The Pennsylvania Constitution says that politicians who are convicted don't have to resign until 90 days, which is when usually the period of time in which they're sentenced. And at the point of sentencing, that's when they must step down. Of course, her attorneys did say last night that they may be having something to say with regards to her resigning within the next couple of days.
Well, and let me give out the we'd love to hear from our listeners through social media, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking about the verdict last night, finding Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane guilty on all 9 criminal charges, including, and most notably, 2 charges of perjury.
Right.
This is an issue that we have covered, as have a lot of people in this Commonwealth have covered as well. You mentioned her attorney, Gerald Chargell. There was some question about why she did not testify. Of course, you don't have to testify when you are charged with a crime, but also didn't mount anyone to testify on her behalf.
No, it was rather interesting. The defense decided to rest after the prosecution made its case, and there was much kind of made of that, you know, why she didn't do that, especially after listening to such damning testimony. There was some expectation that she might bring in character witnesses, people who could kind of vouch for her. But then, and then the interpretation was, oh, she's really alone. She really has nobody to vouch for her. But Chargel kind of dismissed that idea. He said he thought, you know, the media was making way too much of it, and that that's a strategy, and that he admitted it didn't work out.
In fact, we thought it would work, but I'd be the first person to say we were wrong.
Right.
Interesting. Let me play another clip, and this is also from Gerald Chargel. This is Kathleen Kane's lead defense attorney talking about what they might consider if there's an appeal in this case.
We, and those of you who are familiar, and I think that's all of you, are familiar with the history of this case, the so-called porn gate. We believe that our defense was compromised, and we will fight that till the end.
And this is a case that has led us into pornography, or Porngate,
yes,
as it is called, when she was investigating the investigation into Jerry Sandusky, finding all sorts of pornographic and misogynist and racist and hateful emails being traded back and forth.
Right.
A number of people lost their jobs over this. The judges, I understand, did not allow this information to be admitted in court.
No. So before the trial even started, the judge, Wendy Jemchek Alloy, said that the defense was not allowed to use what it called a vindictive prosecution defense. In other words, this idea that Kane was being persecuted by what she's called an old boys network out to get her for selectively releasing all of these racist and pornographic and off-color emails that were trafficked among lawyers and judges and other people in the state judicial system. And so that never came into the case at all. And what Chargel is saying there is, you know, she was wrongfully convicted because the jury didn't get to hear this context.
What happens next? And my understanding is that Bruce Castor, who has a position within the Attorney General's office, is going to have a press conference sometime this afternoon. But what do you see as the next move for the Attorney General and people in her office?
Right. Well, again, Chargel kind of indicated last night that they may have something to say about when she will resign in the next couple of days. Of course, the state constitution says that she doesn't have to until she's sentenced. That will happen within the next 90 days. The sentencing was not scheduled last night. And Bruce Castor, of course, he would be the person in line to replace her if she does, in fact, resign.
Interesting. Let me read a comment from William. These men she took down with her made light of sexual assault and degraded women while overseeing the case involving rape. Kane might have messed up procedurally, but she pulled back the curtain in just how ugly our judiciary is. And I think whether you agree with that or not, certainly the judiciary, the state Supreme Court, all that has been, in a sense, put on its own trial.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's mostly been a trial, you know, that's played out in the media, of course, and with Kane. And again, I think the key here is selectively releasing a lot of these emails. She did not release, and that's been a major criticism of this, the Porngate scandal, is that she didn't release all of them. Now, of course, one question that remains is when we're going to see this report from the special prosecutor, Douglas Gansler. In fact, before I came in to sit here, I sent the guy an email say, hey, can we get an
where
update?
Are we
so
on this?
Maybe we'll have something this week on that. So Doug Gansler, of course, being the special prosecutor that she hired at a very high price for taxpayers to look into these emails, to do a full review of all of the emails. There's thousands and thousands of them. And to, you know, I'm not sure exactly what we expect him to say, really.
A report or whether to release them or not.
Right. Some kind of report, you know, kind of summing up this scandal.
Let me quote something from the judge last night. And this, she said to Kathleen Kane, there is to be absolutely no retaliation of any kind against any witness in this case, either by your own devices, from your own mouth, or your own hand, or directing anybody to do anything. Is that clear, Ms. Kane? The judge asked, and she says, yes, it is, Your Honor.
Yeah.
What was the judge signaling there? And she took away her passport.
She did, yeah. Kathleen Kane was ordered to surrender her passport by noon today. And one strange thing that came up in the trial was a trip that Kathleen Kane and some of her top aides and her twin sister, who also works for the Attorney General's office, took to Haiti right around the time that all of this, you know, turmoil was happening, and around the time that Kane was, you know, allegedly orchestrating this leak of these secret documents. And the judge kind of accused Kane scene of sort of leaving her office in the lurch in a time of turmoil. And actually, the FBI has looked into this trip to Haiti, which Kane has said was purely for charity. But again, that was why she was considered a flight risk. And then this idea of, you know, that she could not retaliate against anyone. I mean, we heard damning testimony of Kane from several of her top aides, you know, one of whom still works in the Office of Attorney General.
That's
David Pfeiffer. He's a special agent who allegedly kind of prepared and helped get her, you know, these and gave Kane a copy of one of these confidential documents. He seemed to kind of, you know, minimize his role in whether he was trying to say to her, oh, here, if you want to pin something on Frank Fina, this is the guy Kane was exacting revenge upon, you know, here, use this. Then nothing like that ever came out in the case, but mm-hmm. he was the one who handed her this memo. And he also interviewed another special agent who had looked into this grand jury investigation. And that interview transcript was a second document that Kane is accused of leaking.
What's the state of the Office of the Attorney General after more than a year of this controversy?
Well, that was another thing that the prosecutors brought up last night. Instead of sort of gloating and you know, saying we won, they talked about how sad a day that this was for Pennsylvania and how this was really, you know, hopefully the light at the end of the tunnel for all of the, quote, suffering members of the state attorney general's office, which, you know, has gone through, you know, many cycles of leadership. Of course, Kane lost her law license. The Supreme Court suspended that. And so she's really only allowed to do administrative things. She is no longer the state's lawyer. She has no law license currently. And she, you know, has kind of had to leave a lot of the major responsibilities of running the office to deputies who I'm sure, you know, have been dealing with also a lot of dysfunction.
And she's gone through a number of spokespeople as well.
She has. She's gone through about six, I believe, in the last year or so. The last one, Chuck Ardo, quit because he said he could no longer explain the inexplicable.
Mm. This was a trial that lasted for about a week.
Yes.
You were there in the courtroom. What mm-hmm. was that like?
You know, it was really interesting because, you know, you read about all of these players, you know, read court documents, you read stories in the Philadelphia Inquirer about, you know, which has really been kind of driving, you know, this story.
Kind of started with them.
Their stories are actually what got us into the courtroom, you know, in this past week. And, to see these people, you know, now sitting in front of you and talking about the roles that they had in this and to see these text messages that Kane sent and to hear these stories about how frantic she became as the grand jury investigation into the leak sort of ramped up was really, really rather striking. It was a peek behind the curtain of sorts.
Well, Katie Culinary, as always, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And she's WHYY's Katie Culinary. She was covering the trial of Pennsylvania attorney Kathleen Kane, found guilty last night of 9 criminal charges, all the criminal charges against her. And we will keep our eye on this case as it goes forward. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. And after this very short break, we'll be talking about vaping. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. The FDA has instituted new regulations for the promotion and sale of e-cigarettes and vape pens. The FDA said it considers these smoking devices to be tobacco products, prohibiting their sale to anyone under the age of 18. It also requires companies to list the ingredients and put warnings on packages and in its ads. The Vaping Association warned these regs could put the industry out of business. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that vaping has increased dramatically among teenagers. Public health officials are divided about the pros and cons of vaping. Most notably, do e-cigarettes help smokers quit, or do they lead non-smokers to take up the habit? We'll be talking about all of this with our three guests. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Sean McCormick, Program Manager for Tobacco Control and Prevention Services at the Health Promotion Council in Philadelphia. That's an affiliate of the Public Health Management Corporation. And Sean, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And joining us by telephone telephone is Michael Siegel. He's a physician, a professor of community health services. That's at Boston University School of Public Health. Michael Siegel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Jillian Mincer, special correspondent for Reuters, who's been covering this particular issue. And Jillian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. Jillian, let me begin with you, put a couple of questions to you, and then we'll go back and forth between all three of you, especially with Sean and with Michael. What do these new regulations then do? I mentioned some of them in my introduction, but what do they do in terms of regulating e-cigarettes and vape pens?
I think you did a really good summary, and the key takeaway is that there's this division because the focus is to keep them away from kids so we don't have another generation of smokers, but also how do we make them available to smokers who feel that they're a good tool to quit smoking traditional cigarettes with. And so you mentioned some of the things the rules did. We have to kind of keep in mind that it took a number of years for the government to come up with these rules. They're hotly debated. And the document was 499 pages to indicate how confusing and these rules are. But while they banned sales to minors, which many people agree, most people agree is a good thing, the controversial point is these regulations that products have to go through, the approval process that they have to go through. What it is if there was a device or a cigar, electronic cigarette or a cigar that did not exist before 2007, they have to basically go through an FDA approval process. And the industry is saying, wait a second, none of our devices really were the same thing prior to 2007, which means that almost everyone has to go through this process. And they feel that almost everyone's product will be taken off the market as a result, except for the very big players like big tobacco.
And there are these small players that are in this industry as well, which is interesting, Jillian.
Yeah, it's gone crazy in recent years with lots of vape shops opening up, thousands of them. You know, this has become a more than $4 billion industry in just about a decade. And there is a concern that this will discourage new innovation with the small players out, you know, out of the picture. At the same time, there were vape shops that were producing liquids for the devices, you know, without any regulation at all. People often referred to it as a Wild West.
Oh, interesting. Let me ask you one more thing, and then we'll get Michael Siegel and Sean McCormick in on the conversation. Do they have to have some kind of warning on packages? And what would that warning be, since there seems to be some contradictory scientific information?
Well, and that's something that I think is still, so many things are still up in the air about the warning and about the safety and how do you prove they're safe. And I think our science guys can, you know, explain some of the pros and cons. But just like other tobacco products, this brings e-cigarettes and cigars under the FDA for the first time. And so what that warning and the exact wording of that warning is, it's still up in the air, but it will be a warning. The bigger question, though, is, you know, who will survive and will it discourage young people from vaping?
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Michael Siegel. Is vaping safe?
Well, vaping is certainly not safe in an absolute sense, but it is clearly much, much safer than cigarette smoking. Cigarette smoking kills more than 400,000 people every year in the United States, and it is probably the single most hazardous thing that somebody can do in terms of a voluntary health choice. Anything we can do to get people off cigarettes is a good thing. And the truth is that the traditional therapies that are out there, like nicotine replacement therapy, and drugs like varenicline, are really not that effective. The success rate long-term is only about 10%. So for those 90% of smokers who aren't successful quitting using the current therapies, electronic cigarettes are a viable option that can help many of them to get off cigarettes.
Well, let me just do a quick follow-up there, and then we'll get Sean McCormick in on the conversation. Sounds like you're saying that if you want to quit smoking, vaping could be a way to help you to do that. But we're learning that teenagers are picking up the habit. They never smoked a cigarette. They're now vaping. How do we deal with that?
Well, I think that what needs to be done is to have specific regulations that prevent companies from marketing these products to kids, that prevent the ads from appearing in youth-friendly venues, and that prevent ads that the content of which targets youth. And interestingly, these are all things that the FDA did not do in their regulations. Instead, they took a really heavy-handed approach and essentially hand the entire e-cigarette market over to Big Tobacco, which is probably the last thing in the world that we want to see.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Sean. How do you see e-cigarettes or vaping?
Well, there's a few ways to look at it, right? There's the individual level, where some people may benefit from them. They may say that they feel better than they did when they smoked cigarettes. Now, do they have a better chance of quitting smoking by vaping versus something else? No, not necessarily.
We don't know that?
We don't know that. The studies have shown things in both directions. Most of the evidence shows that e-cigarettes on the good side may be about as effective as a nicotine patch. On the bad side, they actually may put people at a higher risk of relapsing for smoking. So if people are going around having the connotation, the idea in their mind that this is going to help them, well, we need to look at the research and say, well, we don't know, and there's some data that suggests that it actually puts someone back towards smoking.
So you're saying it's no better, no worse than a patch?
In terms of trying to quit smoking, no. The evidence would suggest it's not necessarily better or worse than the patch. Now, the piece that we always need to add into that is, ideally, someone has a smoking cessation approach that includes both, you know, a pharmacologic or a medication or something to help them deal with the physical nicotine withdrawal, but more importantly, to pair that with counseling, psychoeducation, social support, a quit plan. Without those things, these other tools and their efficacy fall.
Michael, you want to respond to that? And I know that there is not consensus on this, which is why you were both here. But what we hear from Sean is that it's no better, no worse than a patch, if someone is vaping in order to quit smoking?
Well, I think the important thing we need to realize is that you can't have one medicine for everyone. One size doesn't fit all. And there are smokers out there who are successful with things like the nicotine patch or with behavioral counseling. But the reality is that approximately 90% of smokers who try to quit using the patch or behavioral counseling or any current therapy that's available are going to be unsuccessful. And so do we just throw those 90% of smokers under the bus and say, well, sorry, there's nothing we can offer you. You're just going to have to continue smoking and eventually get sick and die because of it? Or do we say, well, look, there's an alternative approach. These products, which have literally helped hundreds of thousands of people to get off cigarettes, why not give them the opportunity? Why tell them, well, you can't use this product. We want you to continue smoking for the rest of your life. It makes no sense whatsoever.
But are you saying that, Michael, that it gets people off of smoking, but do they end up vaping then for the rest of their life? And are there risks associated with that?
Well, yes. I mean, there certainly are risks associated with long-term vaping. We don't actually know what the long-term effects are because they just haven't been on the market long enough to know whether or not they do have chronic effects. But what we do know is that they are much less hazardous than cigarettes. And what we do know is that if these people continue to smoke, they are going to get sick and they are going to die. They're going to get disease. We're going to continue to see hundreds of thousands of people die from smoking every year. And to some of us in public health, that's not acceptable. The status quo with 400,000 people dying, some of us believe that that's not acceptable and that we just can't go along with the current therapy, which has resulted in these 400,000 people dying every year. We believe that there needs to be better options for smokers. And since electronic cigarettes have helped literally hundreds of thousands of people to quit, we see no reason why we shouldn't encourage people who are unsuccessful with other treatments to give vaping a try.
Do you see vaping as less hazardous than smoking a cigarette, Sean?
Well, there's no question that it's much less hazardous.
I'm sorry, Mike. I was pointing that to Sean. That's okay. I pointed at him, but you're not here in the studio. I mean, do you see vaping, Sean, as less hazardous as smoking a cigarette?
Like Dr. Stiegel said, we still have some time to wait before we really truly know. They're not completely safe. Long-term use and huge inhales deep into the lungs with some of these flavorings and the glycols that are in the vape cloud. We don't really know what those are going to do over the long term. There's some evidence that there's reproductive health issues, that there's immunological suppression. So these things are not ideal in terms of, if you were to compare that to cognitive behavioral counseling or even stress management or any of these other non-pharmacologics, there's no downside to those approaches. I think the other thing that we really need to keep in mind, too, is that anytime someone may think about an e-cigarette or vaporizing as a way to quit smoking, the other thing that that does is potentially take them out of seeking tobacco dependence treatment within a healthcare setting.
Mm.
Tobacco dependence.
How common is that and how available is that?
Well, so it's becoming more and more common. There's an sharp increase in the number of certified tobacco treatment specialists. More and more healthcare systems are realizing that this is a chronic disease-like issue that needs to be treated within a healthcare setting, and that when you bring someone into a primary care provider, into a healthcare setting where maybe they have access to a certified treatment tobacco treatment specialist, then they may also be connected to things like diabetes self-management or low-dose lung cancer screenings. So people think that they can quit smoking with an e-cigarette vaporizer, one, maybe be misinformed, and they're not getting the true quality of integrated care that they could be receiving had they gone to a healthcare provider.
Jillian, let me go back to you. And obviously we're hearing two sides of this debate. Are these the two sides that you have been writing about as you've been covering this issue?
That's part of the debate I've been covering, but a lot of it is also the focus on youth smoking. Does it encourage, you know, kids who would otherwise not use cigarettes eventually to use cigarettes? And that's one of the big questions. And we don't really completely know the answer, because some kids try vaping and never start using cigarettes. There is at least one study that indicated at the University of Southern California that teens who vape are six times more likely to try cigarettes, to use regular cigarettes. What we don't know is if they'll stick with the cigarettes. There's also some long-term research coming out of Yale that's showing that while the flavors and are really enticing kids to try them, it's the low cost of e-cigarettes that really keeps them using them. They're typically much lower costs than cigarettes because they're not taxed at the same rates.
Well, let me pick up on that and toss that to you, Michael. I mean, if we're talking about flavors that are called gummy bear or cotton candy, I mean, clearly the makers of these products are targeting young people. I don't think any adult would vape gummy bear cigarette.
There's no question that there are some players out there in the market that are bad actors, and they're putting these ridiculous flavors like gummy bear, you know, on the market. But the majority of the vaping products that are on the market are not those kind of products. Ironically, Big Tobacco, the companies that make the Big Tobacco companies that make these products are not putting out any of these kind of gummy bear or cotton candy type of flavors. But the truth is that many, many vapers like the flavors, and in fact that the flavors are the key to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. If you were to take away the flavorings, then smokers would not be able to be successful with vaping. It would have no interest for them. That's what's so amazing about this innovation, is that it gives an alternative to smokers who want to do something that's healthier for them but aren't able, they're just not able to quit. And for that huge group, which is about 90% of the smoking population, it makes no sense to discourage them from quitting smoking.
Well, let me go back to you, Sean, and talk about how you see teenagers, and I guess whether you see vaping as a gateway device or some kind of a terminal device, a way of getting people into smoking or out of smoking, especially if they're, let's say, 16 or 17 years old.
Yeah, there's definitely evidence of teenagers starting vaping, and there's more and more teenagers now than ever that are vaping. It's up to 16%, I think, of high schoolers have tried it in the last 30 days or have ever tried it. And so are some of those kids, some of those teenagers going to switch to traditional cigarettes? Absolutely. Some will. Some may not, but some will. So, you know, as much as it may be a potential tool for some smokers to quit, there's also this larger population effect in which teenagers in general are seeing vaporizing and e-cigs as normal. And that produces normalization of nicotine addiction and inhaling products and use of tobacco products. So why would we want to set that new standard? We made all this progress in tobacco control, and now we're going to reintroduce a new line of products, a new generation of nicotine-addicted folks that are going to experience the health consequences of vaporizing and some of the health consequences of cigarettes, because they will switch to cigarettes. Some of them will.
Julian, looking at some of your reporting, as you mentioned, the relative cost for e-cigarettes, I guess they're cheaper than actual regular cigarettes. But I wonder whether, too, the fact that people can vape in places where they can't smoke, whether that also has made this an attractive thing to do.
It definitely has. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because the Yale researchers, a report that just came out this summer indicated that it was – while it was the flavors and the curiosity that attracted teens to vaping, it was actually the low cost and the fact that they could do it anywhere, meaning also they could do it and their parents might not smell it, that kept them vaping. And so that, you know, those are issues for teens and for the appeal.
And we're almost having a break here. Are you thinking, Sean, about that these should be – I mean, we don't ban cigarettes in this country, and we all know how dangerous they are. Are you thinking that we should ban e-cigarettes?
No, I don't think that. There definitely needs to be more research in terms of their use as a cessation aid, and to more systematically research that issue and to look at it as, is this a tool that we could weave into the other bank of tools that we have to help people beat their tobacco and nicotine addictions? If we can put together the right research and the studies show that, yes, it can work in the right ways, then, you know, maybe there's some reason to continue to pursue these things. Now, it's not just a healthcare option. This is also something that's used for pleasure and reward. So we're at a very difficult and interesting intersection between a lifestyle / subculture and healthcare. And how do those things interrelate?
Well, we are talking about vaping, some new regulations for e-cigarette producers and products. That's Sean McCormick, Program Manager for Tobacco Control and Prevention Services at the Health Promotion Council here in Philadelphia. Michael Siegel is a physician, also Professor of Community Health Sciences at Boston University School of Public Health. And Jillian Mincer, a special correspondent for Reuters. We'll take your comments after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about electronic cigarettes. They're growing in popularity, having been introduced into the United States about a decade ago. These are battery-powered devices that heat up nicotine and other ingredients that becomes an inhaled vapor, hence the name vaping. And last week, the FDA issued some new regulations for e-cig manufacturers, including the banning of sale to teenagers. And a couple of comments here at Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A comment from Bob. He says the reason for the difficulty of finding consensus comes down to the money potential for producers. They will defend their vested interest, as did the cigarette companies. And I'll put that to you, Michael Siegel, because in many ways the cigarette companies are also making vaping products.
Well, companies are in the vaping business because they see that there's a huge niche, and that niche is for the many, many smokers, which are actually a majority of smokers, who are unable to quit using the traditional medical treatment. And they realize, like many of us in public health, that there needs to be an alternative for smokers who are unable to quit using the traditional nicotine patch. The thing that is so unique about electronic cigarettes, and the reason why they're so effective, is because they address not only the pharmacological aspect of addiction, which is the nicotine addiction, mm-hmm. but also the behavioral aspects and the psychological aspects. It's the only treatment on the market where you can actually go through the behavior that looks like smoking, yet you're not actually smoking. There's no tobacco in the product. There's no combustion. There's no smoke. And that's the beautiful thing about this, and that's why our research has shown that so many smokers who are unable to quit using traditional therapy are able to finally quit using this method.
Sean, you visibly shook your head. No. Go ahead, Sean.
Well, what Dr. Siegel is bringing up is something that I think is actually one of the more dangerous aspects of vaping and e-cigs for people that are trying to quit smoking, and that is the repetitive behaviors. Smoking and addiction – is characterized in large part by compulsive, ongoing, overlearned behaviors, where the smoking behavior is triggered nearly automatically. When someone switches from a traditional cigarette to something else that they're inhaling, they're perpetuating triggers of stress, context, social situations, different scenarios, with a continued use of putting something up to their mouth. So I would think that that opens the door much more easily for someone to then just pick up a cigarette again, rather than developing new coping skills and learning how to interact with the world in a new way.
Jillian, do you want to weigh in on this back and forth?
There is something I'd like to add, and that's that teens have a perception that e-cigs are much safer than cigarettes. They've really gotten the message that cigarette smoking is unsafe. But research, and I've interviewed numerous teens and we've done surveys, really do not see them as having the health consequences that they potentially could have.
Do they see them as safe or just less dangerous than smoking a cigarette?
I think more or less dangerous, but the how safe and, you know, the sense of will I get addicted, will it lead to anything else, is not there.
Is that because of advertising or what peers are saying to each other?
I actually think we've done a really good job at educating young people about the dangers of smoking combustible cigarettes, and we probably need to do as good a job on other devices. Mm-hmm.
You agree with that, Michael?
I think that, in fact, we've done a poor job of educating the public about vaping because the majority of the public actually doesn't realize that vaping is a lot less hazardous than smoking. And all of the scares that have been that we're putting out there, we being people in public health, are actually confusing the public. And if you do, based on public surveys, only about 50% of the population believes that vaping is actually safer than smoking. In other words, half of the population believes that smoking is no worse than vaping. And that's a terrible state of affairs. It's really what's happened is that we've undermined decades of progress in trying to convince people of how bad smoking is. And now we're basically telling them, well, we're not sure that it's any worse than vaping. This is something that the tobacco industry did for decades, and we took them to court for it, and they were adjudicated as racketeers for putting out the false information that smoking was no worse than other behaviors. And this is what we're doing now in public health, is we're basically telling people, look, we're not sure these are any less safe than cigarettes. And that's fraud. I mean, that's fraudulent. We know that they're safer. And we need to be honest with the population. The fact that half of the population doesn't believe that vaping is safer than smoking is an absolute tragedy, and it's inexcusable for a profession that's supposed to pride itself on honesty and truth-telling.
Well, let me read. This is a health advisor.
Can I just respond to that?
Yeah. Hold on, Jillian. Let me just quote something. This is from a January 2015 health advisory from the California Department of Public Health. They said chemicals in the aerosols are absorbed through the bloodstream, delivered directly to the brain and all body organs. E-cigarette emissions also contain volatile organic compounds and fine ultrafine particles. These ultrafine particles can travel deep into the lungs where they get trapped and may lead to tissue inflammation. Jillian, go ahead.
I just wanted to add that Mike's polls are correct, but they apply to adults. There are very few polls that apply to youth because you need special permission when you're interviewing them.
Oh.
So we need to separate those two polls out. That 50%, my understanding, does not include teens. And Yale and some others are really looking at teens' views on these subjects.
I mean, Michael, would you – I don't know if – I mean – Yes, it's safer than smoking a cigarette. But would you suggest to someone if you have the hankering for a cigarette, you could vape your whole life and not pay health consequences?
No, I mean, I don't think there's any question that, and I don't know anyone who is actually telling anyone that this is absolutely safe. The question is, would we rather have people smoking, right, or would we rather have them vaping? And if we could convert every smoker in the United States to be a vapor, it would be the biggest public health miracle of our lifetimes. And what's actually happening now is the opposite. People in public health are discouraging smokers from switching to vaping. And that's ludicrous. And the concerns that are being used to justify that are ridiculous. I mean, the idea that, you know, there are some trace levels of nitrosamines in the smoke, at the, or that there's diacetyl in the vaping aerosol, is no reason not to use them, because the levels of those same chemicals in smoking are thousands of times higher. Mm. So why would you tell someone don't switch from smoking to vaping because there's a small amount of diacetyl in the vaping aerosol when there's 750 times that in the cigarette smoke? The reality is what's happening is that because so many people have been scared into thinking they're going to get diseases from vaping, those people are deciding that they might as well continue smoking. And again, that's a tragedy because, you know, it's like telling people who are in a life in a sinking ship not to use the lifeboats because they haven't been fully tested. What you're basically saying is we'd rather you just die than have a chance of saving your life. And that's exactly what we're doing with smokers.
And let me give Sean a chance to respond, but let me give out the email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY to join the conversation, talking about the pros and cons of e-cigarettes, of vaping. Sean, I mean, we seem to be stuck on this particular issue, whether vaping is safer than smoking and whether public health officials are misleading people if they're lumping them all together. This is what Michael is saying to us. What do you say to that?
That's a fair concern, that there's a possibility that some people may experience some health benefits from switching. That said, there's a possibility that others start when they never would have in the beginning. The more that we normalize these things, the more that they're around, that the more people are going to be picking them up. Now, to respond to Dr. Siegel's statement that no one's saying that these things are safe, I was looking at online. There's a brand of electronic cigarettes called Safe Cigs. There's one called Green Smoke. I'm looking at an ad right here that says, tastes, smokes better than a real cigarette. And then under that, it says, no toxic chemicals. Well, that's not true.
Mm.
So in order for the FDA to jump in and at least start to regulate the messaging behind these things, the advertising around them, we have to do something because there's some of these things are just blatantly false.
Jillian, you want to weigh in on that? Because there are these new regulations from the FDA.
Yeah, no, the FDA, even before the FDA regs, there were states that really were trying to regulate it, like California, where they've brought a number of those companies to court and gotten them to stop selling and stop advertising because that's exactly – they cannot – unless they prove that they go through a different FDA process and do have a medical benefit, and there are – some companies that plan to bring certain devices through that process in the future, that they cannot advertise mm-hmm. that they are safer.
An email from Paul. He says, I'm just curious. Cigarettes are much more expensive than they were when I was a kid. What's the cost comparison of vaping versus cigarettes? Have you looked at that, Jillian?
Yes, it's really significantly cheaper to vape than in many states. I mean, here in New York, it's like $14 a pack. So it's a state-by-state regulation. And a lot of people feel that if we raise the tobacco sale age to 21, as they have done in Hawaii and California and many, many counties and cities, that would discourage youth from purchasing and then add on the taxes. It really varies by state how much more you're going to be paying for your cigarette versus your vaping device. And it also depends on your device.
Michael, and here in Pennsylvania, I mean, most states are looking for ways of raising revenue, and often these sin taxes, like smoking and drinking, become the target of those tax increases, including things like vaping. Would you favor that?
Well, I think it's from a public health perspective, it makes no sense whatsoever, because, you know, we want to do everything we can to give vaping a competitive advantage over cigarettes. When you start putting a 95% tax on e-cigarettes, what you're basically doing is you're protecting the sales of cigarettes. You're doing the greatest favor that you could possibly do to the cigarette industry, which is essentially put this huge tariff on vaping products to discourage people from switching over to the safer product. And in public health, we really need to do the opposite. We want to encourage people to use the much safer product rather than the more dangerous one. And so these huge taxes that states are putting on e-cigarettes are actually feeding right into the cigarette companies' hands and doing them a huge favor.
Go ahead, Sean.
Well, I was just going to say that I would think the ultimate public health goal would be for people that want and need to quit smoking to actually quit and to not rely on another device, one that we don't know if it actually helps. There's, like I said, there's risk that it, you know, increases your chance of relapsing on traditional cigarettes.
So what more can we do to get people, basing on what you just said there, Sean, what more can we do to get people to quit smoking?
Well, so there's an, you know, multiple resources made available to the public. Our organization, Health Promotion Council, is the regional primary contractor for the state of Pennsylvania, and we help coordinate the tobacco quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW, which offers free counseling over the phone as well as free nicotine patches. We also have community and hospital-based services with folks that are specialists in mental health and behavioral health disorders, as well as chronic disease management, so we can tie in tobacco dependence treatment with all these other health care needs. There's also text messaging. It's text to quit. So there are free resources. There's some innovative quit smoking apps developed by the National Cancer Institute. You're going to see more and more wearable technologies helping with this sort of thing. There are other options besides vaporizing e-cigarettes to help people quit smoking.
We have an email from Joy who says she's an RN. I visit first-time mothers and frequently discuss the dangers of secondhand smoke for themselves and their babies. What is exhaled with vaping? Where does the ingredients end up? I'm just trying to summarize here what I'm seeing on my screen. To you, Michael Siegel, are there dangers with secondhand smoke or secondhand vaping?
Well, there have been studies which have shown that the risks from secondhand vaping, if you want to call it that, are really minimal. The vaping process does put some of the chemicals from the exhaled breath of the vapor. They do enter the air, but they dissipate very, very quickly. In fact, within seconds, they dissipate. And the exposure to nicotine is essentially close to non-existent. So there's no question that secondhand vaping that the risks are very minimal. And certainly compared to secondhand smoke, there's no comparison. With that said, I would never encourage anyone to vape around their children. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a kind of a no-brainer that you wouldn't want to do that or expose a child to any kind of exposure like that. But I do think that the alarms that have been set off about secondhand vaping being some sort of terrible hazard have really been overblown.
We are almost out of time here, Jillian. Looking at these regulations, will they be rolled out over the next couple of months or years? What's the status on that?
Sure. Well, August 8th was a big day. That was, if you didn't have your product on the market by that day, you'll now need to get approval prior to putting it on the market. So you saw lots and lots of companies literally putting prototypes out to meet that deadline. And then more will be rolled out. What's interesting about our conversation is I think we all agree we don't want kids.
No.
We want people to quit smoking. We don't want kids using anything, but a lot more research needs to get done to answer a lot of these questions.
Well, I think all of us could agree on that. Jillian Mincer, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Special correspondent for Reuters, Michael Siegel, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's a physician, also a professor of community health services at Boston University School of Public Health. And Sean McCormick, thank you for joining us in Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Program manager for Tobacco Control and Prevention Services at the Health Promotion Council here in Philadelphia. And that's an affiliate of Public Health Management Corporation. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.